Hi everyone, I'm Jeff Gaudette, Chief Running Enthusiast for Runners Connect, a community of expert coaches dedicated to providing runners the motivation, answers, and training you need to achieve your goals. This is our interview series where runners, coaches, and proven experts come on here to teach you what they've learned along the way so you can grab as much information as possible and apply it directly to your training right now. All of our previous episodes are available at runnersconnect.net, or you can subscribe to our iTunes feed to get updated as soon as we post new interviews. On today's show, we're interviewing Jay Johnson. Jay is one of the premier coaches in the U.S. and an expert on strength training and keeping athletes healthy. Jay is the director of the Boulder Running Camps, coach at Nike.com, and has coached three U.S. champions over the last 3 years. To say he knows his stuff is definitely an understatement. Today, Jay is going to help us understand how adding strength work, warm-up routines, and cool-down routines can help keep you injury-free and make you a better athlete. Jay is really one of the premier experts in the field, so if you're interested in the science and physiology of how, when, and why to incorporate strength training into your running, you're going to love this interview. Without further ado, let's get started. And to get started, Jay, I wanted to say thanks for taking the time to join us and share your expertise with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm excited to chat about running. Obviously, I enjoy it, and hopefully I can say something that's helpful.
I'm sure you will. You're definitely filled with nuggets of wisdom, so I'm excited about this.
Great. All right.
Just to get started, I want to give everybody a brief introduction into kind of your running and coaching background for those who may not know you. When did you start running? What were some of your notable accomplishments in running itself?
Yeah, like a lot of people, I started actually before. I actually did track, in elementary school, late elementary school, in a summer program where you showed up maybe twice a week for 6 weeks in the summer, then ran the Hershey track meet. Okay. And I wasn't that good at it, but definitely in junior high, started to get better and liked it, and then ran cross country and track in high school. I was fortunate to play on a really good basketball team. And then got really lucky, in my mind to live in the state of Colorado at the same time that Mark Wetmore was starting to coach at the University of Colorado, and just barely ran fast enough to walk on at CU. And, it's just one of those things in life where I just feel really blessed and, completely lucky that he was the coach in the state I was living in, because obviously he's one of the best coaches in our country, if not the world. And so I ran much faster with Mark as my coach than I would have, we have to assume, than had I gone to the Division II school that was offering me a scholarship at the time. So
good decision on your part.
Yeah. And so fast forward, let's see, I went to grad school at Colorado. My fifth year of running was my first year of graduate school. And most of your listeners are probably familiar with this idea that you can use 5 years to complete 4 years of athletic eligibility.
Right.
So I was really busy that year. Some of your listeners may or may not be familiar with running with the Buffaloes. So that year that book was written, I was in grad school.
Let me interrupt you real quick. Yeah, if anybody hasn't read the book and is listening, it's called Running with the Buffaloes. It basically documents the, is it 2001, Jay? Or 1999?
It's season. Actually 1990, fall of
98. Yep. Okay. And it's a phenomenal book. I probably, maybe in my running, here's my running nerd coming out, I've probably read it about 20 times. It's phenomenal. So if anybody is looking for a great book to read in this fall, definitely check it out. So sorry, I just wanted to let people know a little bit more about the book.
Yeah, and I just put it in there just to give people context. I was studying, the name of the department has changed, but at the time it was called Kinesiology and Applied Physiology. Now I think it's just called Applied Physiology. And that second year, I wasn't running on the team, but I was doing a lot of trail runs, staying pretty fit, skied a lot that second year of graduate school. I'd work on my thesis from 2 p.m. in the afternoon till 10 p.m., but would find a way to go for a run or maybe drive up and go skiing, get a few runs in the morning. So that was a great year of life.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And so then I went to a junior college. I really wanted to coach. The only job I could get was at Pratt Community College in Pratt, Kansas. After 2 years there, I was able to come back to the University of Colorado and coach. And I coached at CU for 6 years. And that was really a fantastic opportunity. But then it just made sense for my family and I, for us to have me pursue something else. So we had our first child, and my wife has a pretty demanding job, so I had a bigger part in the childcare. And then I did have enough time to start coaching some professional athletes. And so over the course of about 3 years, coached some professional athletes. Three of them won U.S. championships at various distances. So I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah, that's pretty successful, I would say.
So, you know, coached for 3 years, had three people win national championships. That's decent. But, you know, I'm not coaching any professionals right now, and that really makes sense in my life. How do I want to say this appropriately? It's really hard for the athletes to make a living in track and field. Mm-hmm. And so as a coach, you can't really ask too much of them financially for your time.
Right.
But the flip side is I could ask a high school athlete's parents for quite a bit of money for my time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not ideal either, you know, to have me as some sort of club coach or private coach when they already have a high school coach. But I just bring that up to kind of, you know, we're coming off an Olympic period where everybody's watching on NBC or, you know, watching it online and thinks, man, track, it's so prestigious and it's so cool. And it is at that level, but there's like one rung or two rungs below it where there's people who, you know, take the sport very seriously, but are barely getting by. Mm-hmm. And we could talk, you know, for hours about what we could do to fix that. But all I'm trying to say is that my focus in the next year or two, if I can find the time to coach some post-collegians, that's great, but it'll have to be the right situation. And really excited about the things that I have going. I've been the director of the Boulder Running Camps for about 10 years now, and it's successful, but we think we can grow a little bit more. And then I have a website called runningdvds.com, and we only have two titles right now. But in the next 6 to 12 months, we're really going to work hard to produce some more titles. We already have the footage for our next title. It's just up to me to edit and produce that next DVD. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Awesome. Yeah, it sounds like you definitely have a lot going on. And, you know, just from your background, it sounds like you've been interested in the coaching / science side of running for quite some time. Did that kind of develop in college, or when did you feel like you really wanted to be a coach?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I took the dental admissions test and had all the prereqs to go be a dentist, and had applied to the University of Colorado Dental School, and I had this, you know, looking back, unrealistic kind of idea that I could, in my fifth year, start dental school, but then commute back up to Boulder for practice, and, you know, never would have worked. But, yeah, I mean, it was just I don't know, you know, I was reading Phil Jackson's book, Sacred Hoops, mm-hmm. As we were driving the bus to the Big 12 indoor meet. You know, this is when I was an athlete, and on the way back, I don't even remember if I ran well or not at the meet, but yeah, if I ran mediocre at best, just to put this all in perspective. You know, I was a 14:25 K runner, so that's pretty pedestrian these days, but you know, on the way back, I remember talking to Mark about it, and, you know, he definitely had a positive influence there. I think this is part of your question, too. When I first started coaching, I had a master's degree in basically exercise science, however you want to term it. Mm-hmm. I know I had too much of a macro, excuse me, a micro, a desire to understand on the micro level what was going on. So for instance, I thought if I understood how the mitochondria helps you run aerobically, that I would become a better coach.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been better off, you know, hanging out with, and I did do this finally when I figured it out, the baseball and the basketball coach, and just figure out how do they work with 18 and 19-year-olds. And specific to my first job, you know, I wasn't a kid who went to a junior college, and a mm-hmm. lot of best athletes I had, you know, they were non-qualifiers, meaning they didn't have the test scores to run in Division One. Some of them definitely had the talent to run in Division One. Or in NCAA Division II. But the point is they were good athletes. But, you know, academically they really struggled. And so just little things like had I been more empathetic to how hard study table was for them,
mm-hmm.
you know, compared to being at CU where, like, my buddy Chris Severy could just sit on a bus during an eight-hour ride. Like, we drive 8 hours, we get lunch, and we drive another drive four hours, get lunch. That guy would be hunched over an organic chemistry book studying every single minute, where I would study 2 hours, go gossip with, you know, Tom Reese for 5 minutes as my study break, thinking I was working hard. And my buddy, I mean, I can vividly see this in my mind right now, just looking like six rows up and seeing him hunched over a book, just cranking it out. So anyway, to bring this full circle, it's just I really like this coach. Some of you probably aren't familiar with Vern Gambetta. His roots are in track and field, but he's known internationally as a strength and conditioning coach. And he talks a lot about communication and how mm-hmm. important it is in the coach-athlete relationship. And like I said, when I first got into coaching, I had this my view was too narrow and was really focused on the science and physiology and whatnot. And I think there's a place for that, but I guess my point is I don't think it's primary research, you know, white paper that should inform your coaching. Mm-hmm. I think talking to other successful coaches and really understanding how people work and how groups work, you know, that's mm-hmm. what more is amazing at that, like helping individuals become a group and then getting that group to perform, you know, for instance, in cross country at the national championships. I mean, he's fantastic at that. So, I just think that when I first started coaching, I was too focused on these micro level things. But hey, in this conversation, I'm happy to talk about some of those, you know, in the weight room, why you might do a box jump after a speed squat, and why you might start a progression with the overhead squat before you go to a back squat. I mean, there mm-hmm. are some, you know, detail things in training that I do believe in, and, you know, it's taken me a decade to figure some of those out.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate you being so candid about it. I do think a lot of aspiring coaches fall into the same trap that you did, you know, thinking where the physiology of it is so important, and really it comes down to communication, empathy, you know, learning how to handle logistics and organization and that kind of thing. But then I think as you get older and probably in this place that you are, it definitely starts to, then you kind of come full circle and the physiology starts to kind of come back. And like you said, talking about, you know, when you're going to do specific exercises at specific times of the year. So I think it's pretty cool that it kind of came full circle for you, and it seems things have balanced out pretty well.
I'll give you an example. I work with this athlete, Brent Vaughn, or I don't currently, but I did, and we went to the Houston Half Marathon, which is the U.S. Half Marathon Championships, and he just totally bombed. He was running great, pushing the pace a little bit. And my theory is that they went under this oak tree, and he must have some sort of weird allergy. You know, there's, at the time of year, January, there's all these funky tree pollens and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, he just couldn't breathe. Okay? So for whatever, and I don't think it was nerves. I mean, you know, an intelligent listener might be saying, you know, he's at the lead. Was he doing that because he was scared? But a week later was the U.S. Cross Country Championships. And we just did one workout in between. We knew he was fit. We got a little bit lucky because a lot of the neuromuscular, like the rhythm of what we had been training at, and mm-hmm. I forget the numbers, But when I looked at what I thought he could run for the half marathon, it wasn't that much different than what you had to run on grass over a hilly course for 12K, which was the distance of the cross country championships. And so we just did a workout he'd done a ton in his life. We did a workout that he'd done at the University of Colorado during cross country. And it was snowy, so I had to shovel 500 meters on this AstroTurf field, which is fun. and he ran great. And I guess my point is, like, that week we were on the phone a lot. There was a lot of text messaging, but there's a great example of my job then had very little to do with the physiology of the workout. And the workout we chose was a workout he had done a million times. So we weren't getting cute with that, but it was, you know, it was, I mean, he really did a good job himself. Within an hour or so after bombing at the half marathon, he said, "I've got to race again because I'm really fit." Mm-hmm. But I just think, you know, there's an example of, you know, you spend a week either trying to get the athlete not motivated, but get them back in the mindset of, I'm going to compete well, and then trying to rest up. And all that has way more to do with psychology than it does physiology.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's cool. And I guess kind of along the same lines, maybe a little bit, you know, kind of going a little bit back about to your coaching background. And definitely stop me if this seems unfair. But sometimes I think you're probably characterized maybe in running circles as like the strength running coach, because you talk a lot about it, and you have obviously some great videos and demonstrations and routines. Something I've always been curious about personally is just coming from kind of a Mark Whitmore system, which is very Lydiard based, and it seems to be mostly focused on running with very little ancillary exercises, at least from what I understand about it. In terms of your progression as a coach, how did you take that college experience that you had and kind of being exposed to that training environment and then coming full circle to kind of maybe where you're at now?
Yeah, I don't want to bore your readers, but your listeners, but I'm going to have to give you a longer answer to really answer it.
Okay.
I'll preface it by saying, yeah, I don't love the categorization of, you know, Jay Johnson is the guy who just does ancillary work and doesn't believe in running. You can't have people win national championships if you're not running a lot. Right. At this day and age, I mean, you go back 10 years, there were some, you could cherry pick some races and they were, you know, pretty weak. But, you know, not to get off on a tangent, but there's basically no U.S. championship in either gender, whether it's on the roads or on the track, that's easy now. Mm-hmm. So that's cool that we've come a long way. But anyway, so I was the middle distance coach at the University of Colorado, and I felt I was really lacking an understanding of what to do in the weight room. And so I just spent a lot of time. I definitely made it a focus of the training, but I definitely spent a lot of time trying to learn from the strength coaches. And I'm embarrassed that I haven't kept in good touch with him, but there's a man named Vernon Stevens who is now a strength coach with the San Diego Chargers. So he got to see you about the time that I got to see you, and we became close friends in addition to, you know, from on a professional level, me really asking him, you know, why are we doing this? It started as, you know, you write the strength program and I'm going to observe. And mm-hmm. then it was more like, why are we doing this? And then towards the end, I had a pretty big say. I was working with this woman, Sarah Vaughn, and during the last couple of years that she ran really well, first of all, Vernon left to go to the Chargers, but secondly, I just felt comfortable assigning the weight room stuff. And it's an important point to make to your listeners is I don't view any ancillary work as separate from the running work, meaning I think the analogy is that the running's the cake, and a lot of people think that this ancillary work is just the frosting on top of the cake. Mm-hmm. And I think of these things as completely integrated into intelligent training. So for instance, you know, there's some stuff I believe in now from Phil Wharton, some active isolated flexibility stuff. And I view that as the first stuff you should do, let's say in the first 3 to 4 weeks of any training. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody were to be one of your clients, and hire you as an online coach, I would recommend that they start this 3 to 4 weeks of active isolated flexibility. And then there's some routines that are on the internet that I've shared with Running Times or with Nike. A routine that people know is called the Myrtle routine. It's cheesy. Myrtle rhymes with hip girdle, and your hip girdle is basically, you know, the joint, the hip joint, but then all the muscles around that. And we're just trying to strengthen that area. We're also trying to gain mobility in that area for a lot of athletes. But you know, you can't, I mean, it also strengthens your back, strengthens your butt, strengthens your hamstring. And that's the most basic thing. And then this is probably the point where I need to interject Mike Smith. Most people will know him. He's the coach of Christian Smith. And in 2008 at the Olympic trials, Christian Smith was the guy that dove at the line in the 800 and just barely made the team in the 800. Pretty dramatic race. Mike Smith was at Kansas State, or still is at Kansas State. And when I was at CU, I would see his athletes doing these warm-ups that, you know, they were using a med ball and they were doing plyos. And then I'd see him in the cool down process doing all this work. And so I just went up to him and started picking his brain. And, you know, let's be honest. There's kind of, it's probably easier when you're coming as the coach. He would talk to anybody. Okay. I'll refer to another coach in a moment who I definitely had, I got lucky with my in with him. But Mike was somebody who just would share everything, would send me copies of all of his stuff. He might send me a list of exercises and a cool down or stuff they would do after the run, and I literally wouldn't know half of the exercises. I might not know 2/3 of the exercises. So it took me a while to learn it, and this ties into the running DVDs business. At one point, I realized I should just go make a DVD with this guy because, A, I think it would be popular and people would be interested, but, B, I just need to learn this for my own coaching edification. I need to learn this stuff, and what better way to learn it than to try and edit that DVD and watch all those exercises, see how he puts them together into routines.
Right.
So Mike Smith was a really big influence, and you know, it's probably fair to interject at this point. As a middle distance coach, you know, I might have had a half a scholarship or one scholarship, and you know, was on the men's side, you know, and was coaching several men with that one scholar. You know, what you do in the NCAA, for people that don't know, is there's only 12.6 men's scholarships, but you need about 50 guys on the team. So you can take a full scholarship, and let's just for argument's sake say you're going to get 4 guys on 0.25% of a scholarship.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I had one guy who was on more than that, but then a couple guys on 10% or whatever. And I just felt like, you know, the Big 12 indoor meet has a 600, an 800, 1,000, a mile, and a DMR. If you don't have some bodies in the middle distance events, you're not going to do well. So there was, at least indoors, some pressure to have people healthy. And some of this was, you know, learning what I would term preventive work to prevent injury.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, and this is where I was just on the cusp of understanding this, but now, you know, however many years later, I definitely am 100% devoted to this idea that you should do preventive work while you're training. And that if you want to train harder or train more miles, you should also have a plan to be doing more preventive work.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chance that later in your career, you could get away with a little less preventive work, which sounds counterintuitive, but if you've done enough of it, let's say over a lifetime, then you'll be fine. If you watch the Olympics this year, in the women's 800, I think there's a really interesting just fact that kind of would slap you in the face. You can only have 3 entrance from each country in an event. And we saw on the track how Jamaica and the U.S. sometimes could get 3 people in the sprints. But in the women's 800, Russia had 3 women. And I just think that that really shows, you know, long-term, well, I mean, your listeners may or may not know this, that in those former communist countries, they have a long-term plan. They might identify an athlete at 14, and they have a plan for up through the time they're 24 or 28.
Mm-hmm.
And, it starts with a lot of exercises and, you know, athleticism. Where in our country, you might be identified as a soccer player, and then you start running, and then you don't do any of that work, you know, in the frontal plane. Well, there's three planes of motion. The sagittal plane is how you run, primarily. There's mm-hmm. a little bit of transverse plane motion with your shoulders and your hips, but the frontal plane is moving side to side. So you'd see that as a shortstop in baseball, or maybe as a somebody playing basketball or soccer. Well, the point I'm trying to make is you lose some of that athleticism when you start just running.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another way to view this, is that we're trying to keep the athleticism in the runners kind of daily and weekly training. But to go back to kind of the story of how I got into this, my dad works at the University of Texas, and there's two things that came about from his job, basically. One is that he knew Dan Pfaff.
Mm-hmm.
Pfaff, as many people will know, is one of the best, you know, I might argue he's the best track and field coach in the world. But when he was at Texas, I just, you know, he liked my dad and he was willing to talk to me. And so I would just pepper him with questions, and half the time they were over my head, but I kept listening and would go back in between meets and try and research stuff. And he was just, I mean, just a few conversations with him really made an impact on me. And then another thing is, there's a strength coach that works with the men's basketball team at Texas named Todd Wright. And Todd Wright works closely with a physical therapist named Gary Gray. So Gary Gray, I was able to doing what's called the lunge matrix as a warm-up with the basketball team. And now we don't do it exactly the way he does it, but we do a lunge matrix for runners that's five different lunges. And I really believe in that. I believe in it as the first thing you do when you get out of your car, you know, at the trailhead or at the track.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe after this interview we can reference like what a week might will look like with all this work put into it.
Yeah, definitely.
But the idea is that, you know, I didn't understand the lunge matrix until my last couple of years at CU, and didn't even trust it right away, because for the first 2 or 3 weeks, it's going to make your quads a little sore. I mean, you are lunging,
mm-hmm.
but as you're using, again, going back to kind of that hip girdle idea, you're using a lot of muscles. I don't use the term core quite as much as some people, because I think it still has the connotation of, you know, six pack abs.
Right.
But those core muscles from kind of the bottom of your rib cage to kind of the middle of your thigh, if you look at that big area, that includes your glutes and the, you know, upper hamstrings, and, you know, people talk about the transverse abdominis and its importance. And there's all these things, the iliopsoas muscle, you know, you're really stretching those things out, getting them to warm up, getting them to fire. Yeah, and then let me just kind of top it off with this. In the last few years, I feel like I'm using some of this stuff as a diagnostic to figure out how tired the athlete is.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you might do a backwards lunge on a lane line. Or if you're in a parking lot, you can just do it on the painted line for the parking spots. And the reason you might do this after a long run, well, first of all, you need to get to where you can do it when you're rested. So try it as part of a warm-up. It's great for a warm-up because it gets your glutes firing.
Mm-hmm.
And running with your glutes not firing eventually is going to lead to injury. Probably, I'm not an expert in this, but I think most good therapists who deal with runners might say that, you know, whether it's glute maximus or glute medius or whatever, basically if your butt is weak, the chance of IT band goes way up. And if you looked at 10 people with IT band problems, almost all of them would have weak glutes. So whether it's strengthening the glutes or just getting them to fire, or getting them to warm up a little bit before your run, I think the backwards lunge is great. I like to use the backwards lunge then after a long run for the simple fact that there's also a neuromuscular component. And the more I coach, the more I realize that, you know, like these professional athletes, they can do high-level aerobic stuff even when they're a little bit tired. But, you still can't trick the nervous system. When the nervous system is tired, it's done. It's like it's binary. It's either on or off. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when the nervous system is done, when it's off, you're going to see somebody wobble in that backwards lunge. Even if they had, let's say, a 20-mile run where the last, you know, 6 or 7 were at marathon pace, or a 16-mile run where they were doing a fartlek at half marathon pace. And I just think that it's helped my coaching, because a lot of times we do a long run, let's say on Sunday, and then ideally we'd like to come back to the track on Tuesday or go back to the roads on Tuesday. And then if they really suck at that, excuse my language, if they do a poor job at that backwards lunge, maybe doesn't mean we always move the workout back to Wednesday, but it gives me food for thought that, okay, maybe this athlete is tired. Maybe either we shouldn't work out Tuesday, or we should really water down the workout. And I think there's going to be, in the next 5, 10, 15 years, a lot of new things. There's some things you can do with I heard Brooks Johnson at a USATF symposium talk about looking at the eyes and having some sort of, like, eye scan to tell what the nervous system I think it has to do with alpha waves or this is stuff I need to bone up on, because I don't completely understand it. But there's definitely, to kind of wrap this up, there's things in the sprint world that distance coaches need to understand. Mm-hmm. And so I'm talking around that issue right now, is that sprint coaches, all they deal with is the nervous system. From a metabolic standpoint, there isn't as much going on. Let's say that the 100 meters. In the 400, you know, that research out of Australia a few years ago showed that the 400 is fueled by the aerobic system by about 33%.
Right.
But the 100, you know, it's just a function of power, and power relates to strength. And when you're trying to gain strength, it's usually just a function of understanding how the nervous system works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I think that's phenomenal. And if I can kind of build a little bit off what you were saying, especially with the nervous system and identifying fatigue. One of the things that I had a lot of trouble with trying to incorporate strength training into my own routines is trying to balance, like, when I was too tired, you know, and trying to identify when something was more just like, okay, I don't want to do this, or I don't want to be, you know, I want to be done now, or balancing that with, you know, am I really too tired? You know, are my muscles fatigued? This is going to affect my next workout. So it sounds like using these routines is really actually a great way to identify, you know, when an athlete might be tired, a way they can self-identify, you know, when they may actually need a little bit of rest.
Well, I think there's two issues here. The first one, I'm going to speak as a coach who's worked with professionals, where time isn't an issue, mm-hmm. meaning an unlimited time to practice. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to have 8-hour practices, but it does mean we can practice for, let's say, 3 hours. So in that, and then let me talk after that about what do I assume most of your listeners and most of your clients have to deal with, which is a limited amount of time. And I think underlying your question is also this choice. Do I spend 10 minutes on general strength, or do I spend 10 minutes getting another mile and a half in? You know, at 7-minute pace, they could get a mile and a half in 10 and a half minutes.
Right. No, that's great. I'm glad you're going to bring it up. You read my mind.
Yeah. So, but let's go back to the first one. I said this earlier, and I really believe this, that for the Western athlete, or let's just say the American athlete, you know, is one thing when we had people in an agrarian society, you know, so farm boys who were chasing pigs and hay up into a loft, you could just give them a ton of training, whether it's interval training because they were a 400, 800 guy, or, you know, let's say in high school they're a 3,200 meter runner and you could just have them go run miles and miles. Well, we're working with weaker kids. And by the way, I'm stealing a lot of this philosophy from Mike Smith at Kansas State. But we're dealing with people who are weaker. Now, their engines are very good, okay? So you can have an athlete come out of college who has a very developed engine but has had some injury problems. And to me, I might even lower their mileage depending on where they are. And yet, if you counted the number of minutes per week that we're doing work, so doing stuff with med balls, walking over hurdles, doing body weight stuff, you know, body weight squats, or again, Phil Wharton's active isolated flexibility. It's really boring. Most people find it boring, but it's really, really essential in my mind. You do all that stuff and they're working way more minutes per week than they would be when they were in college, just running. Mm-hmm. And so how do we know when we should stop doing that stuff or if we should continue if we're tired? I think I kind of get misunderstood in terms of how much work we might do in the weight room or how much work is intense. So intense meaning like plyometrics, or intense meaning a speed squat where on your back you've got your body weight or maybe 1.25 times your body weight. I was fortunate to work with a middle distance runner named Sarah Vaughn who could do a ton of work in the weight room. And if she had done enough of it in college that when she was a professional, I would let her do some of the, well, because of time, she had to do most of those workouts on her own. And she could do what she considered a pretty easy day in the weight room would have been hard for most people. Mm-hmm. And we do that most days. I mean, even if her workout was kind of flat, she'd probably go to the weight room. But the flip side is her husband, who is more of a distance runner, who is now, you know, going to move to the marathon and no doubt be successful. We would just do general strength stuff, postural, like you can walk over hurdles and it's more of a postural thing. Mm-hmm. You're working more of those minor muscles to really get your posture right, to get your hips level. And if you're really focusing on those things, it doesn't mean that they can't get tired, but it's not, you know, it's not the same output. It has nothing to do with power. And I guess it has to do with strength, but not strength in the context of like a max, you know, a max, what you can squat max or what your max bench press is. Now, if we take it back to what an adult should do who's, let's say, qualified for the Boston Marathon, that athlete is so serious that I'm coaching a guy online right now who is going to run New York. He was a college runner who is often injured, and he is just willing to do everything that I assign. And I don't know really how he fits it in with his job and his family and whatnot. But I was actually reading something this weekend about all these CEOs, you know, who do Ironmans and run marathons. And I just think there's a certain personality in America that if you tell them off your marathon time, but you need to give me 15 minutes a day, 5 minutes before your workout, 10 minutes after your workout, doing this ancillary stuff. And I also, here's an important part for your reader or your listenership. You have to value this work as much as you value running. So I think what happens with a lot of post-collegians and a lot of college kids is they value 10 more minutes to running more than they value doing some of these routines for 10 minutes, or actually they should do them for 20 minutes, mm-hmm. Okay? Just to keep the numbers straight. I'm often saying, yeah, rather than 10 more minutes of jogging, you know, we do cool downs where we do skipping and then we do some barefoot running and it only adds up to like 2 miles. Well, there's some, you know, post-collegians, professional runners that go cool down 4 miles, or some people think they always have to do a 2 mile cool down. I'm saying, no, do a 1 mile cool down and then do the rest of this stuff for 10 or 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And what I'm really asking, Jeff, is that people add more minutes into their week. I think that's the one thing where, you know, I'd write articles for Running Times or I'd put stuff on my blog and I'd try and really cater to the person who says, well, I don't have more time. And I think the more I do this and see kind of this cycle of injuries with people where they get the same injury over and over, mm-hmm. It just makes me trust the fact that if they did more of the ancillary work, and I'm not saying, okay, here's an example. Let's say you need to do 10 miles at marathon pace. And let's say you're going to warm up to and cool down to. All I'm saying is maybe cool down one and then add 20 minutes of general strength. When you really look at it, you're really only adding 10 minutes because you took off 1 mile of running, or you're adding 13 minutes, you know, however quick you would cool down. So it's not in the great scheme of things. I mean, it's maybe 10 less minutes with your family or 10 less minutes watching a TV show. It's really not that much time. Uh-huh. The lunge matrix, for everybody who knows it, takes 3 minutes and 30 seconds. And then I like to see some people do some leg swings against a wall or a fence. That takes roughly 90 seconds. So we're asking 5 minutes before the run. Where it gets a little trickier is with Phil Wharton's active isolated flexibility. You know, sometime if you have time, you could interview Scott Douglas, one of the editors of Running Times. He's been doing Phil Wharton's work for about a year now. I think it's about a year. And it has totally revamped his running. He feels like a complete different athlete running.
Mm-hmm.
But that stuff takes time. You know, Scott doesn't have kids and can devote more time to it. And, you know, I know with my own running and trying to get back into, I'm in horrible shape right now, trying to get back into shape. I know I need to do more of Phil's stuff. And yet it is hard to say I'm going to be stretching with a rope for 20, 30 minutes at a time rather than going for a run.
Right.
So, and that's extreme. To finish this, what we're looking at is over, let's say, a 7-day period is you're not doing that much less running, but you are doing a lot more of what I would term general strength or general strength and mobility. And for the average Boston marathoner, you never need to go to a weight room. You can do all the stuff at the track or at the trailhead. You do need to bring a yoga mat because a lot of the things you're lying down or, you know, you're assuming that table position from yoga where you're on your knees and you're on your hands.
Mm-hmm.
If you can spend $20, might be $30, and get a nice med ball that bounces, you can do a lot of work with a med ball. So.
No, I think that's that was a great response, and it's definitely something that I've come around along in terms of, you know, my own philosophy in terms of training and running, and I think that's probably the hardest thing that I see, and you kind of identified it, is just, you know, where do you fit it in when you're already, you know, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and trying to fit all this stuff in. But I think you're so right when you talk about just, you know, it's really, you know, and the real basic essence of it, you know, really only needs to be 10, 15 minutes a day. And it's, you know, you can definitely cut some things out, you know, a warm up here, a cool down there, and add those in. And it definitely goes a long way long term in terms of, you know, keeping athletes healthy, which is obviously the most important part. If you can get an athlete, you know, if an athlete, and I like to think of it this way, if an athlete's running 5 miles a week less, but a healthy 100% of the year, that's better than running an extra 5 miles a week, but being hurt every 3 months, you know?
You highlight a important thing, and I'm going to put you on the spot here. You don't know about this, I don't think, but I have a friend who's also from Maine, and his name is Patrick Wales Dynan, and he wrote a great article on my blog about consistency. And I think it ties in exactly to what you just said. You know, you're somebody who values consistency. I think every listener should really, really kind of burn this into their head, this idea of if I ran 5 miles less per week, but I stayed healthy during the entire year, that's better than running a little bit more. And there's a chance I'll work with a post-collegian coming up here in the coming weeks and months. And if I do, as I looked at their training, I thought, you know what, there's no need for them to run more. It looks like they don't run very much right now, but there's some big deficits in terms of strength and flexibility and mobility, and they have a history of getting injured all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, why try and bump up mileage? And, you know, if you follow the sport closely, you can see even at the professional level, there's some people who seem to really bite off a big chunk of mileage at some point that are injured, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I think along the same lines, I remember after the Olympics, Alberto Salazar was quoted somewhere. I can't remember if it was an interview or a paper or whatever about Mo Farah's training, and saying that when he first met Mo, he was the weakest athlete that he had ever met. And over the course of the few years that they've been working together, all the work that they've done, I mean, he said, you know, Mo is now one of the strongest athletes that he's met. And I think some of Mo's old high school/club coaches, you know, a little bit different in overseas, have said that, you know, he's dramatically transformed kind of how he looks and his running form, just in terms of how powerful he is. And obviously that was on display in the final lap in the 10K and the 5K.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, where I saw this personally is I worked with this woman, Sarah Vaughn, who aerobically, I mean, she couldn't run a very good 3K at the same time where she was could make the USATF final in the 1500. Mm-hmm. And not that, you know, there's other athletes like that probably, but it just, it highlights that power, you know, is an important power, posture, are really important. There's obviously papers that you're familiar with, that talk about doing plyometrics and they're interesting because in both the test group and then the control group, the VO2 max, so basically a measure of aerobic ability, is the same.
Mm-hmm.
The plyometrics had a greater running economy and therefore ran faster. Or a better way to say it is they ran faster, and then you attribute that to a greater running economy.
Right.
And I'm not very good at doing interviews like this because probably should have talked about running economy back in minute number 10 of this interview instead of minute number 45. Because running economy is just how efficient you are at a given pace.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that Frank Shorter, for instance, had one of the lower VO2 maxes when he was being tested, whereas Steve Prefontaine had one of the highest. Yet for a marathoner, he was so efficient that he could get away with a lower VO2. And ideally, you'd want both, right? Ideally, maximize both ends. And, you know, when you're talking about Mo and Galen Rupp, coached by Alberto, I mean, I think both are true. They're really strong and they have great mechanics. And those guys, I went to a symposium up in Canada in December where Alberto spoke, and those guys are doing intense workouts. I mean, they're working really hard. But then that begs kind of the chicken and the egg question. Are they able to work that hard because they're doing so much strengthening stuff? I saw Galen Rupp after he won the U.S. Junior 5K in College Station. This is when John Cook was assisting Alberto. And I saw him walking over hurdles and then doing repeat Ks. This was after the race, walking over hurdles, doing some hurdle mobility, then doing repeat Ks at probably, you know, half marathon pace or, you know, they were very aerobic, very, very smooth and comfortable. Then coming back, walking over hurdles, doing some more. So just really improving his work capacity, but also coming back to strength and posture.
Mm-hmm.
And for your listeners out there, let's say you can choose between two tracks when you do your track work. If there's five or six hurdles laying out at the one track, start choosing that track. And I've got some example of hurdle mobility from a Nike video that hurdle mobility is just a great way to gain flexibility and to improve your posture. And I need to put out some new videos because the Nike one only shows, I forget, three or four different exercises, but there's many exercises.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll throw up we'll touch base via email after this, and we'll throw up some of those links at the bottom of this for anybody that's just listening to this interview. If you go to the website, you'll see that we'll list some of the links to the routines so you can check them out and download them and incorporate them into your routine.
Great.
And then just one, I guess, kind of final question, Jay. You talked a little bit about kind of building progression from the strength training side in terms of starting with some you know, active isolated stretching, some of the Phil Wharton stuff, and then progressing to kind of the Myrtle routine, working with the, you know, the hips, kind of, you know, core in the untraditional sense of, in terms of, you know, everything from the hips, the glutes, the lower back, and that kind of thing. And then kind of progressing into more advanced stuff. But, and that's probably on a micro level in terms of maybe each training cycle kind of thing, at least from the way I understand it. But how do you progress in terms of from season to season, from year to year? Is it adding more more repetitions to the routines? Is it adding more weight? You know, how do you keep athletes progressing and as opposed to kind of getting stagnant?
Yeah, not to overcomplicate, but why don't I answer it kind of three ways, all right? So with Phil Wharton's active isolated flexibility work, if you just did the flexibility, you're way ahead of the game. He has a progression then of strengthening work where you do things with ankle weights or things with dumbbells. And again, I'm really excited to produce the DVD I'll be producing this fall is showing this stuff. It's with Phil.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really think that's a great example of start with flexibility, move to a little bit of weight. Then he has a pulley system that you actually do some more intense weight work on, or he might move you to things like step ups and lunges and squats. Okay. So that I think is a nice, nice progression of work. Some of my work, that I believe runners should do, I think the lunge matrix is a great example of, you're going to do 5 lunges on each leg and there's 5 exercises, that's 50 lunges. I never have people do more. We don't do less, but we don't do more. Week number two, or year number 2 and year number 3, you're doing that as your warm up. And the thing is, after you do that, I mean, I saw an athlete in Boulder who I no longer coach, and saw him at the track the other day, and he's doing his lunges. Because at this point in his career, he feels funny. I mean, I didn't ask him this, but I know it because I know it with myself. You feel weird if you don't do it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So with some of this stuff, you just hit your baseline pretty early and you never do more. I think the stuff that there's 3 things, there's maybe 4. So there's the Phil Wharton type progression. Then there's the stuff like the lunge matrix or the Myrtle routine. I never add more reps to Myrtle. Myrtle should take just 5 or 6 minutes. Okay. And from Myrtle, then the next part of this would be more challenging cool down routines that add a little more general strength. So because they're cool downs, I think jazz singers are cool, all my cool downs are named after jazz singers. Okay. So the Cannonball routine, named after Cannonball Adderley. We have the Grant Green routine. And so these are routines that are more challenging. We have the Lionel Hampton routine. These are routines that are more challenging than the Myrtle routine. I have something called the first 20, which is a 20-minute routine that involves med balls and throwing them. And, you know, it's a little bit challenging, but it moves into more cool-down stuff at the end of the 20 minutes. And then there's the second 20, which after you've done the first 20 for, let's say, 2 months, and you'd only do this after your hard days, by the way. I really believe in keeping your hard days hard and your easy days easy. Then that would move into the second 20, which is a little more challenging. Then I think kind of the fourth area is what to do in the weight room. And, you know, and not to discredit the people listening, but I just don't see a large percentage of your listeners really needing to do this type of work in the weight room. Uh-huh. But you might start with something like an overhead squat with the bar. Then you might move to a front squat with a little bit of weight. I really like the speed squat at like a half squat knee angle. So then that knee angle translates to about 3K pace or 1500 meter pace. I don't know if you can envision that, but if you squat halfway down, your leg is in the position it would be when your knee comes up in the air and you're running faster. Okay. Take that same premise, you should go lower as a sprinter because your knee lift is higher, okay? But, you know, after 2 or 3 years in the weight room, we might do a speed squat progression where you go as hard as you can for 12 seconds. I'll put a box under the athlete's rear end so basically they can feel their butt hitting the box and then they go up as hard as they can. We might walk around for 90 seconds, then do some box jumps. Then we'll take 3 minutes in between those. Sets, to me, they're exercises that really complement one another. And by the way, the weight room, I think for a distance runner, you should be in and out, you know, 40 to 50 minutes. You should get in there, you should warm up, you should go hard, take your appropriate rest to recharge the creatine phosphate system, do some mobility before you leave the room, and then leave. So yeah, those are some things. And I guess a fifth thing could be circuits. I definitely, and now I'm not talking about circuits with weights. I'm talking about circuits where you run in between. Mm-hmm. So I did some videos for running times where you're running circuits at, or the running is at about half marathon pace. Could, for somebody who's a novice, could be marathon pace. But you run, let's say, 700 meters. You start jogging 50 meters or 70 meters, and then you do a bunch of exercises, jog another 30 meters, and then you go right back into that 700. And so that's a great way early in a training cycle to get, A, a bunch of general strength, but B, keep the amount of running low, yet you can get a 40 or 50-minute workout but cover fewer miles. Mm-hmm. So it's a safe way to try and get fit. But I bring up the circuits because – in year two, man, the exercises can be a lot more challenging. And in year three, I mean, you should really be able to do some challenging work and still run, you know, half marathon pace.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That was very helpful. I appreciate that. I think that was phenomenal.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, yeah, this has been great. Obviously, you know, you basically can't shut me up talking about this stuff.
No, I really appreciate you being so generous with your time. And I know this is just something our audience is going to love to listen to and definitely take some notes. And again, for everybody that's listening and not on the website already, you know, definitely check out the links. We'll have some at the bottom to all the routines that Jay's mentioned, to some of the resources that he's gone over, and you can definitely check those out. I definitely think adding them to your, you know, running now is going to make a big difference. And again, like Jay and I talked about briefly, you know, consistency, keeping you healthy, and that kind of stuff.
Yep, that's the goal of all this. If we could use one word to, you know, as our goal, it's consistency. And so this entire podcast, if you can take one thing away from it, it's the idea that some, quote, non-running work can lead to consistency.
Awesome. I think that's a great place to end it. That's pretty awesome.
Okay. All right, Jeff. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks, Jay.